Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willett, and this episode's guest, Faith Hunter. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers, the podcast where I talk to other science fiction and fantasy authors about their creative process. I say other because I am myself. Oh, I'm Edward Willett, by the way. I'm your host. I'm also a science fiction and fantasy author. And in fact, this very week, on July 28th, my most recent book from Daw Books in New York came out in mass market paperback. That's Master of the World, which is book two of the World Shapers series, from which this podcast kind of gets its name. The World Shapers series, as I've explained before, but we'll explain again, takes place in a vast labyrinth of shaped worlds, and the shapers of those worlds live within them, rather like the authors I interview on this program, as if they lived inside the worlds that they create. Most of us probably wouldn't actually want to do that, but the shapers in my labyrinth of worlds do want to do that. They were placed there by the mysterious Agrair, who's kind of the spider at the center of the web of the labyrinth. But this adversary, this enemy of Agrair, has made his way into the labyrinth, and he's starting to take over these worlds, and his goal is to get to Agrair and eventually destroy the entire labyrinth and all the shaped worlds within it. That's the big picture. My main character is Shauna Keys. She shaped a world very much like ours and was living happily in it, not remembering that she was the shaper, which is very odd. And then Carl Yatzer, a mysterious stranger, shows up and explains things to her and tells her that the adversary is in her world and she has to move on, but that she has the power as a very powerful shaper, even though she doesn't remember it, to gather the knowledge of all the shaped worlds, take it to Agrair, and save the labyrinth from the adversary. So in the first book, World Shaper, they basically flee her world with a lot of adventures along the way. Book two, the one that is just out now in mass market paperback after being out in trade paperback and ebook before that, is called Master of the World, and it takes place in a world that was shaped by someone who really loves Jules Verne. So it's full of strange devices, submarines and airships and floating islands and all that kind of stuff. So that came out this week, as I said, on July 28th. This podcast is going live on August 1st. And is now available in mass market paperback, and that's leading up to The Moonlit World, which is book three in the series, which, as I like to say, is werewolves and vampires and peasants, oh my, as Shauna and Carl find themselves in a world shaped by someone who really likes werewolves and vampires. And they have to deal with all of that as they try to find the shapers of the world and get the knowledge of the shaping of the world so they can take it to Agrair. That's coming out on September 15th, and that's why if you've been following this podcast, you may think, wait a minute, there was a podcast out just a week ago with Edward Savio, and usually it's every 2 weeks. Why is there already another one? Well, two reasons. One, I have lots of great interviews already in hand, but two, because I do have books coming out, this is my opportunity to give them a little bit of a push. So please make this all worthwhile. Go out and buy my books. That'd be really nice. another book coming up that I really want to mention, and have mentioned before, is the anthology Shapers of Worlds, which draws from the first-year guests of this podcast, some really great names in there, original fiction and reprints from people like, Tanya Huff and Shannon McGuire on the original fiction side. There's also Lee Modisett Jr., DJ Butler, Christopher Rocchio, John C. Wright, Shelley Adina, and me. On the reprint side, we have people like Joe Haldeman and David Brin and John Scalzi and Julie Chernadin and another whole great list of people there, Fonda Lee. So if you go to the World Shapers website, theworldshapers.com, I have a picture of the cover art there. As of this week, I forgot to mention David Weber is one of the original fiction writers. As of this week, I have all of the stories, so I'm editing that now. It was kickstarted, and the Kickstarter backers copy will go out first, and the ebook will become available right away. That should be in September, I'm thinking. I'll have that all finalized with a proper release from my own Shadowpaw Press, shadowpawpress.com, coming out in before Christmas. I don't want to be too definite. It will be, I hope, well before Christmas, but definitely before Christmas, later in the fall, I guess I could say that. So those are two things coming up that I hope you will check out and stay on top of. And I do hope if Shapers of Worlds and the anthology is successful, and I think it will be with the people involved, I do hope to go on and kickstart Shapers of Worlds Volume 2, where I will be inviting the second year guests to this podcast to submit as well. And in fact, as of today, August 1st, we are at the 2 year anniversary of the launch of the podcast. So this is kind of a special episode in that. Episode 58, from which you can tell I have done a little better than every 2 weeks. I've gone to 1 week schedule once or twice before. Alrighty. The only other thing I need to mention in the top part of this is that the World Shapers podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. All right, let's get on to this week's exciting guest, Faith Hunter. Faith Hunter is the award-winning New York Times and USA Today best-selling author of multiple series, including the Jane Yellowrock series and the Soulwood series. She also wrote and sold the first of the Junkyard Cats novella series as an Audible original. Junkyard Cats was the number one selling book at Audible when it was released. And she's also written 3 Rogue Mage series novels, 2 anthologies in that series, and co-authored a role-playing game. She's the co-author and author of 16 thrillers under pen names Gary Hunter and Gwyn Hunter. And altogether, she has 40-plus books and dozens of short stories in print and is juggling multiple projects. I'm not surprised. She sold her first book in 1989, hasn't stopped writing since. She collects orchids and animal skulls, loves thunderstorms, and writes. She edits the occasional anthology and drinks a lot of tea. So, Faith, welcome to the World Shapers.
Thank you for having me. This is so much fun.
Well, thanks so much for being on. We made the connection because we're both Penguin Random House, and I mentioned to my publicist that, you know, I had this podcast and I could talk to authors, and next thing I knew, there you were. So
I am just absolutely thrilled to be here. This is wonderful.
So we'll start with my usual sort of taking you back into the mists of time. Someday I'm going to put reverb on that, the mists of time. and also at the end when I do the big philosophical questions. But
well, you've got a big voice, so you can pull it off without the reverb. It's very impressive.
I echo in my own head. but going back into the mists of time, how did you get interested in most of us, it starts with books, reading and writing, in particular the kind of fantastical stuff that you write. How did that all come about for you?
I started out as, like a lot of writers, as the weird kid in school who didn't fit in anywhere, who fell between all of the cracks, and just had a reputation of being strange. So when you're strange, you start reading, and you read strange things. And I read Pern, and I read all of the old masters of science fiction, as they're called. And I read fantasy and mystery and began to work my way through thrillers and just simply found a place where my head and my heart could be at peace. And that was in somebody else's world. So when I hit 10th grade and my 10th grade teacher told me that I had writing talent and I should make writing my career, I believed her, for better or worse. And thank you, Carol Kohler, for telling me that that little gem of poetry, horrible poetry that I wrote, had merit. And she set my life, 10th grade teacher, set my life on its course.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I often ask if there was, you know, teachers or mentors or something early on. And I think many of us, if we're lucky, we encounter somebody like that. So so that was in the 10th grade. Did you do a lot of writing in high school? And did you share your writing with other people?
I did. And we had a literary magazine, which all of the literary pieces were turned in anonymously. And I turned in about, 40. And when the literary magazine, and there were, no one knew, different people picked everything. And when the literary magazine came out of about 60 pieces, something like 20 were mine. which cemented my teacher's recognition of my work. And so that was my first moment to really think that I might be a writer, really believe that it was possible. And being my father's daughter, he was an engineer. I started working to discover how writers lived, how they did their job. So I spent hours at the local library talking with the librarians and letting them give me magazines to sit and study, and asking permission, may I please tear out this form here so I can get this magazine at my house, and being given the opportunity to learn the hard things about writing, as it was at the time, which is you have to have a finished project to be paid, and you have to go through a process to be paid by New York. And I worked for 3 solid years, through 10th, 11th, and 12th grade, to educate myself on the business of writing as it was way back in the Dark Ages, mm-hmm. and to teach myself as much about the tools of writing, the methods of writing, as I possibly could.
It's interesting that you mentioned your father's an engineer. I'm married to an engineer. My wife is an engineer and past president of the Association of Professional Engineers and Geoscientists of Saskatchewan, in fact.
Wow.
And one thing I have found being married to an engineer is that engineers approach problems very analytically.
Yes.
More so than perhaps comes naturally to me. So sometimes when she's approaching something, I think, oh, I never thought of that question.
I tend to, because of my father's deliberate training in debate, I tend to think of worst case scenarios, which is really, really helpful when you're writing fiction, because you want your character to face the worst thing possible short of death and come out some sort of a hero. That's your goal as a writer, to make that transition from flawed character to successful character take place amidst the conflict that the character's facing. So because of Dad demanding that I debate him constantly, I think in two different ways when I'm writing. Part of me is deeply involved in the methodologies and the toolbox things. How do you phrase this? How many times, what is the meter of my prose? Where's the last time I used a gerund? Oh, this sentence runs on too long. Versus the worst case scenario, which is, this isn't bad enough, I have to make this worse for my reader to really get into this scene. So those two parts of my brain are always working together now. My mother's creative self and my father's engineering lessons in the reality of logic.
Where did you grow up?
All over the South. Dad worked for a paper company. And back in the day, big international paper companies would, because everybody was, I mean, they were everywhere, because everyone was reading newspapers. And so he was in the newspaper making arm, and he was an electrical engineer. So we moved to different, we never spent more than 4 years in any one place. And usually it was closer to 2 years. It was 2 years in Mississippi, and 2 years in Louisiana, and it was just all over the Southeast. And then Dad took a job in a little town called Rock Hill, South Carolina, with a different paper company, and we stayed there for many, many years, and that's where I went to school.
Now, when you went to university, did you study writing? Because you initially started in, what, biomedical laboratory
yes.
work?
No, I went to tech school. This was long enough ago that you could go to a 2-year tech school, and the post-World War II scholastic situation was still in place, so you could go to school for 2 years in a science-based or an engineering-based job. And in a lot of them, you could then take the 4-year test and you could get credit for 4 years of school. Mm. So that's what I did. Dad, in all of his debating, never told me that I was going to have to pay for my own schooling because he wasn't going to do that. And so I had to go to school the cheapest way it was possible to do it. And that meant the local tech school and study really, really, really hard so I could pass that test, which I did. And I had a good job with benefits for 40 years before I felt brave enough and strong enough in my writing career to quit.
Yeah, when I was looking into writing when I was in high school, I made the decision that you can't actually make a living at it right off the front. And so right. I went into journalism, so at least I was doing something with words. But
I thought about journalism, and there was a local college I could have gone to. It would have taken me about 6 years to pay my way through, or maybe 8. But the idea of working in hospitals and being helpful to people was another part of my personality. And clearly I liked it enough to stay with it. Mm-hmm. So that was, and learning the sciences and having a science background gave me an opportunity to learn a different type of writing, because report writing is very much like journalistic writing in the sense that you have a different timeline and you have different verbiage and you have different methodologies of reaching a point. So that was helpful in its own odd, unique way.
Were there other helpful things about working in that job for all those years? Has that fed into your writing in any other way?
Well, let's see. Yes. I spent many years at small hospitals, and in small hospitals, there's an awfully lot of job crossover. So I took part I was the assistant for lots of autopsies, and I was the person who went to the morgue and drew vitreous fluid or did a suprapubic stick to get urine or did a heart stick to get blood from the accident victims or murder victims or whatever was down there. And I was a part of the in-house first response team for all codes, which means if someone stopped breathing or crashed in surgery or whatever, I was right there. And then took the samples back to the lab and actually did the processing. So in a small hospital, you very often get to do and see more, a lot more, than the average person does today. I don't know if that's the answer you really wanted, but yes, I've put all of that learning together. So when I describe a dead body at any point, I can do it with at least a modicum of success because I've seen it. And when I need an injury that doesn't kill someone, I've also got that. I've seen everything. So yeah, it was very handy to my writing.
I usually say that no matter what you do, you'll find elements of it are useful in your fiction writing. It's like you have to have something in the tank before you can, you know,
absolutely
have anything to write about.
Absolutely. People who sit in an ivory tower don't know how to write about real life problems. They have to get out there in some kind of a trench. Now, it could be politics, it could be anything. But sitting in your basement or your living room or anywhere on your hiney and not being involved in the world does not prepare you for the writing life. You have to have a background and a knowledge, not just of the English language, but of the world.
And I would think working in that kind of environment, you also saw a wide range of people.
Yes, and a wide range of victims and a wide range of perpetrators and a wide range of everything that, to start out with, I didn't have the life skills to deal with, because I started my on-the-job training at 18. And that was difficult.
I would imagine. Were you writing then all through this time as you got your 2 year and then moved into the workforce? Or?
I gave myself 2 years off. I did from writing. I did no writing during those 2 years except what I had to do for school, which was report writing, essays, the usual college stuff you still have to do even if you're at a tech school. You still have to take writing courses and English courses and your basic math and that sort of thing. So I gave myself time off because my job was to get a four-year education in 2 years. So the day I got out of school, walked across the stage, and the day after that, I went to work researching for my next book, which had been percolating, my first book, I should say, which had been percolating in the back of my mind for 2 years.
Did you take any formal writing training at any time? I always ask that because some writers do, and then they say, but it wasn't very useful.
I did. I took three options in the tech school. One was actually a... that's been a long time ago. It was a creative writing course of some sort. I don't remember what now. And then when I was trying to write my first book, I took a poetry course from a two-time Gutenberg winner at the local college. And I took a short story course from a writer who was a critically acclaimed writer and also taught on the side. I learned a lot from those two classes, and the poetry class taught me to cut action words, all the things that you need to make your prose really strong. And the short story course taught me things about plot and conflict and story arc that I needed. So those two courses did come in handy. I don't think I needed much else at that point, and I was ready to go because, as I said before, I studied hard for 3 years. I read every book I could find on writing. I read every magazine. I got every possible writing magazine came to my house, and I studied them and marked them up and dog-eared pages and not of the books, because I got those from the library, but of my magazines. I made it a point to study. And if you really work hard at it, you can teach yourself a lot of things in life.
What was that first book, and how long did it take you then to complete it and presumably submit it? Did it get published?
It actually was finished, and I had about 2 inches tall of rejection letters, because back then there were probably 150 publishers out there. And I put it aside when I met a cop in the emergency room one night, and I heard him talking about wanting to write a book when he retired. We got chatting and started working together. Our first lines were, I wish I could remember that first line that we came up with together. Something about a warehouse with the stink of winter and rats that only a good raising could cure. And at the time, it sounded very poetic to me. But that first book took about, that second book for me, first book together, took 5 years for us to write, and the first editor who looked at it bought it.
What was its title?
Uh, Either Death Sentence or Death Warrant. I'm not sure which came first, but it was a two-book series. It was called Police Procedural.
And
long ago.
And you've written a great many since then. 40 plus, I believe your bio said.
Yes. I only count up when I think I might have hit another 10. So I don't know where I am right now. I do know that I have one book coming out in July, the end of July, which is Spells for the Dead. And I have I'm in the middle of rewrites for the Junkyard Cats number 2, which doesn't have a real title yet, but I'm calling it Junkyard Bargain, just for funsies. So I know I've got those still coming, and then I have turned in book 14 in the Jane Yellowrock series, which is my most popular series at this point, and it is in the hands of the editor waiting for that lovely thing writers call a rewrite letter, but is really the letter of devastation and misery.
Well, we're going to talk about that because we're going to talk about your process. So first of all, then maybe we should have a synopsis of Souls of the Dead. And I want to talk about the Junkyard Cat series too, because I wanted to ask you about the difference between writing direct for audio and writing
dear,
for
print. Dear, you want to know about... And of course, my brain is not on Spells for the Dead. Wait a minute.
Yeah, I know. Something that you did a long time ago because you're working on the next thing. I know how that goes.
Right. Wait a minute. Let me see. Let me pull it up so I can look at it. Wait a minute. It's horrible when you have to. Sometimes I can't even remember my own titles. That really happens a lot. Okay, well, Nell Ingram is the main character in the Soulwood series, and that series is a paranormal police procedural slash with fantasy with a little tiny bit of romance woven through it. Not enough to turn off my male readers, but you know, enough to make my female readers happy. Nell works in Tennessee out of Knoxville, and she's called to the Tennessee mansion of a country music star and finds a disturbing scene, which takes us back to something we said just a few minutes ago. She sees dead bodies rapidly decaying before everyone's eyes. And the witch on her team has never seen magic that can steal life forces like this. So Nell and the team have to go in and solve this mystery and prevent these new dark magics from spiraling out of control.
Okay. And what's Junkyard Cats about?
Junkyard Cats is science fiction. And it is fabulous. I am having the most fun with it. The series is about post-World War III, post-alien invasion, and forced peace on the Earth by the aliens because we were destroying ourselves and our planet. And my character is in hiding because she was accidentally contaminated by two different kinds of nanobots, and they've done something to her. So Shining Smith is her name. She's a former biker with the Outlaws. And she runs Smith's Junk and Scrapyard in the middle of West Virginia, in the middle of the West Virginian desert. And the cats part are because she has cats, which you discover at some point in book one are actually sentient thanks to her.
Mm-hmm. Well, those both sound very interesting. This is a cliche question. Where do you get your ideas? But it's a valid question. How do ideas come to you? How do you get the seeds of stories? These ones specifically, but in general, how does that process work for you?
Well, of course, when you're writing a series, you don't have to worry about world building or character creation or character relationships. All of those are already in place. So when I'm working on the Soulwood series or the Jane Yellowrock series, what I'm planning is mostly plot related and character development related. That process is very different because you start out in the middle of a well-designed, hopefully, world. And you bring in the little bits of the world that you need for this particular book. But you have to also be smart and know that maybe your readers haven't read all of the other books. And so you have to be very clear and concise about the necessary history for your character that you present in this new book. So you start out in a different place from a standalone book or the beginning of a new series. So when I start with a Jane Yellowrock or a Soulwood book, it's usually with plot. Who's died? Who's in trouble? What conflict are they facing? Is it natural? Is it mundane? Is it magical? Is it in the case of the science fiction, is it technological? Is it related to the damage that was done to the earth in the war? What problem is this now established character facing? That will do two things. Number one, challenge the new and the remaining weaknesses in that character. That's number one. And number two, take that character through a journey where that character has to change and become better or worse in order to accomplish the end. So if I'm just looking at an established character and all I'm doing is the plot planning, that's one type of book to start. And I do that with an extremely heavily detailed 7 to 35 page single-spaced outline.
That was my next question.
Now, when I'm doing something brand new, for instance, Junkyard Cats, all I knew was the beginning and the end. My proposal to myself was about two pages, and it was as much world building as anything else. And then I realized, of course, I have to have help. So I got two physicists to help me set up the changes in technology in the world, and they were extremely helpful. And I got some readers handy who would be able to help me with some genetic changes. So then I just, for the first time in literally, well, since 2006, I pantsed something. Mm. I flew by the seat of my pants, and I actually wrote the outline so I would have a way to keep track of what had happened as I wrote each day's writing. So I would write what I wanted to that day, and I would transfer it to the outline. Then I would go back and write the next day's work, and I would transfer the necessary information to the outline. And then about halfway through, I realized I needed to start my Bible because I was loving this. And the Bible is all of the things that are going to happen in a series. And in this case, it was technology and characters. So I have about a 25-page single-spaced Bible now, and I've only got one novella published in it. So the process is different. When I started Junkyard Cats, it was all about the creation of this character, the creation of the world, and how much did I need and how much was just fluff. And how much do I put away, and how much satisfies me as a writer? Because sometimes, as a writer, I need to be satisfied with the craft of writing. I need to have that that good poetic feel to things, to my work, that makes me happy and may not do anything for my writer. So it's a juggling aspect when I'm pantsing it. It's very different. It's okay. It's more fun. Let me just say this right up front. Pantsing a novella is way more fun than writing from an outline.
When you started working on that, were you thinking direct to audio, or did that come along later? How did that work?
I finished it and I sent it to my agent and I said, let's see, how did that work? Oh, I remember. They had Audible had asked me if I had anything that they could use as an Audible original. This was some time ago. And I said, nope, not a thing. Everything is under contract. But I kind of got an idea in the back of my head. If I ever get time to write it, I'll let my agent know. So I finished all of this and I sent it to her and I said, I doubt that this is anything that Audible would be interested in. But if you think they would be, here. And she read it and made some significant suggestions because she's the excellent, wonderful agent she is. Am I permitted to say her name?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, Lucianne Diver of the Knight Agency is fabulous. And she made lots of suggestions, which I incorporated into a rewrite. And then she took it to Audible, and they bought it as an Audible original. So it is still under, they had a 6-month exclusive on it where it can't be in print anywhere, and the 6 months will be out at the end of July. So sometime in August, the end of August, I think, it will come out as an ebook from a small press.
I'm sure you've had, most of your books have been audio books. Do you ever listen to them?
Really, I don't. I hate to say that because my fans adore my narrator. They think she's the cat's meow.
Yeah.
Christine Vam can do all of the voices, and she's really good about keeping them in place between book and book and from the beginning to the end, and the characters always sound like they're supposed to. But if I listen to the way she speaks my character's voices, it won't be what I hear inside my head. So, no, I don't, and that's embarrassing, but I love you, Christine, but no, I have not ever listened to a book.
That seems to be fairly common in authors I've talked to, and I haven't listened to, except for the ones that I commissioned myself and I had to do the proof listening, and I liked them, fortunately. but yeah, the ones that I've had that have been done by some other company, I've never actually listened to the whole thing, and it's kind of the same thing. It's like, well, that's not quite the way it sounded in my head. So.
Right. I mean, it, and then when you go back to starting the next book, I would have to go back and reread a whole bunch in a previous book to find that voice again, because my books don't sound alike. The authorial voice is totally different in every book. I mean, in every series. So the way I write, the syntax, the punctuation, every little thing is different in the Jane Yellowrot books from the books that I wrote as Gwen, which are much more purple. Those have a lot more flavor to them, in a sense, because the characters are not warriors, and Jane is a warrior. So my authorial voice is so different. If I listened to anything, I would have to go back and reread, and that would annoy me, mm-hmm. I guess, some.
What's your actual writing process? I think I read that you aim for a certain number of pages a day.
I do.
Are you a fast writer or a slow writer?
Well, COVID has changed the answer to that. Normally, when I was writing and trying to get a book out every 6 months and working full time, I wrote for 12 hours a day, 5 days a week, and then worked 2 16- to 17-hour days at the hospital. And while I was fast, I was doing 2 books a year, so I was always behind. And a good week was 10,000 words. Then I quit the job and realized I was killing myself, so I switched from a book every 6 months to a book every 8 months. And that was much more doable. I was not killing myself anymore. And so if I could do, let's see, how much would that be? If I could do 8,000 words a week to 10,000 words a week over 7 days, that was a lot easier on me. And then COVID hit and I can't go anywhere. So I'm back up writing way faster and I'm getting caught up on all of my deadlines. And I'm not sitting at the desk, but about 6 to 8 hours a day. And it's pretty wonderful. So I hate to say that COVID has been beneficial in any way, but it makes me concentrate on my writing so I don't have to think about the world. And I think I know that a lot of my writing friends have had the opposite effect where they can't think about their writing because the only thing they can think about is the world, and it's horrible, and everything's on fire. But for me, I'm hiding from that when I'm writing. I'm not watching the news. I'm not checking Facebook or Twitter. I'm not going anywhere but into this world, and I can sit and write, and it's pouring out of me, and it's wonderful. Now, I don't know if that will continue. What has it done to you? I mean, I'm really curious about how other people have reacted to this.
It hasn't really changed much for me. I work at home. I was writer in residence at the Saskatoon Public Library, which is a 2.5 hour drive north of here. So I would go up on Tuesday morning. I stayed overnight and I was in the library for 2 days meeting with writers and going, you know, stuff like that. And all that changed was that I no longer made the trip to Saskatoon and I just sat here and did it all virtually. And actually benefited me because I wasn't spending money on that hotel room one night a week up in Saskatoon. So that all went by. And, you know, I always sit in my house and type. So it hasn't really changed much from my point of view. But I've heard that, you know, different things from different people. I assume from what you said that you mostly write at home anyway. You're not a go out into the coffee shops or scribble under a tree with a pen or something.
Absolutely not. I want my computer system set up exactly as it's set up. When we go somewhere to paddle, I still have to write, and I take all of my computer system with me. So we travel in an RV, and it has a big, deep dash. So when we are stopped and I am working, I still have my two great big screens and my laptop to the side. And so that gives me two keyboards. So I have two full systems to write with, because especially now that when I'm writing a series, I have to have so many different files open. Mm. I've got to have the Bible open. I've got to have maybe the previous book open. I might have to have the writing order and the time schedule open. I might have to have the editor's notes open. So when I'm writing, I always have at least 4 files open at a time. And all of them are related to this project that I'm working on. So I have to, I just, when I go somewhere else, I replicate my office.
Hmm. Once you have that first draft, what does your revision process look like? Do you have a very clean draft once you get to the end and you're done? You don't have to go through it again? Or how does that work for you?
Well, I've been writing for a long time. When my father was passing away, I had about 3 years there where I did not turn in very clean drafts. And I felt very sorry for my editor. And they kindly, at Penguin Random House, kept working with me through those 3 years. But normally, except for those 3 years, I start out the day revising everything I wrote the day before and then putting in another X number of words to get to where I need to be for that day to meet a deadline for the week. So, for instance, if I know I've got a 40,000 word document due on Monday, and I've got 7 days to do it in, then each day I've got to, each week I've got to do 10,000 words. So I just divide it up, and normally I'm able to make it. Lately, though, I've had some health issues myself, so I've given myself a little bit longer. I'm not pushing myself. I'm just letting my COVID brain write all the time, and I'm not watching word count as much as I did before. So everything changes. It just, life changes. People get sick. People die. Your dog dies. You and your husband get to go on vacation to Ireland, and you don't write the whole time you're there, and then you come home with all these ideas, and you have a brand new concept, and you sit down and you write like crazy. So life is just odd, and the writing process is always have to change based on the reality of the world.
As they say, life is just one darn thing after another.
Yes, it is.
Do you, it doesn't sound like you have beta readers or anybody like that, or do you?
I used to not, but I do now. I have one beta reader who keeps up with the timeline and the Bible and makes sure that all of the characters are where they should be at the start of one book based on where they were, where they last appeared in the series. So if I've killed off a character, the character is not back in this book. So I have her, and she is...
Well, in your book, couldn't that happen in your series?
Yes. Well, it did 3 times by accident. And that forced me to introduce an accidental time loop situation. So that gave the Jane Yellowrock series five more books because I made that accident. So no one's complaining, except the poor person who has to keep up with what I've done. And she was, the timeline editor has also been a nonfiction editor. So she's really good about, the broad strokes in the editing process. So she's a beta reader, but I also now, she started out as a beta reader. I now pay her to be my timeline editor. And I have a genetics person who does plants and people genetics. And she's also one of my PR people. I have personal PR people as well as the wonderful people at Penguin. So, yes, I have 2 really regular beta readers that I use. And then this last time, I have 2 people who are, 3 new people who are beta readers for Mindset and Weapons from a former, so that they... A new character I've never written in his brain before, so that he thinks properly when he's faced with danger. My character, Eli Younger, is a former Ranger, active duty in the Middle East, and when he comes home, he's injured. Now I'm writing a story where he has to face a bad guy that he doesn't have any of the weapons needed to fight. So part of this new novella I'm working on is through his point of view. And I needed to make sure that the weapons he would choose, the number of shots fired at this creature, the way he would... his body mechanics would work during a fight, and the way his brain would work, because those are all parts of one whole. And so I have 3 brand new beta readers who were very helpful in this new novella.
Hmm. Once you get the book submitted, and you mentioned the letter of devastation from the editor, What sorts of things do you usually find yourself having to do in the editorial pass?
Really, really good stuff. I have the best editor at Penguin ever. I've already told her if she ever retires or I'm quitting, and she laughs, and I go, you know, I might be serious here. But she catches things like plot holes, like, this makes no sense. You said this here, then you said this here 40 pages later, and they have no connectivity. So you need to address this, and you need to bring this, you need to create a connectivity between these two events, and your character needs to work through this. And she'll say things like, your character sounds mean, or your character sounds like you, or why would your character know this? This character does not have any backstory that gives him or her a knowledge base in this area, and you sound like an expert. Because, you know, I did my research, but off the fly, a character wouldn't have time to. So it's not just the nitpicky things, it's the big, broad strokes of the novel. It usually starts out with, this was so much fun. I always love getting back into this. Here's five single-spaced paragraphs of what's wrong with it. And then here's all the nitpicky things in the next five pages, single-spaced.
And who is your wonderful editor?
My wonderful editor is Jessica Wade at ACE, at Penguin Random House. And I cannot recommend her enough. If you can get in with her, she's fabulous.
Well, my editor is the only editor. Well, I've worked with multiple editors, but the only one in my major publisher is Sheila Gilbert at DAW, just down the hall from ACE, actually, in the Penguin building.
Very good. Well, but they're all working at home now, so.
Yeah. She actually is in New Jersey.
But is she?
What's interesting about Sheila is that, because I talk to authors and everybody gets these written letters, and Sheila doesn't give you a written letter. We have very long phone conversations, which is, just different. But it's the same thing, you know. This character can't do that, or you never set that up, right. Or you know, it's the same sort of thing. And when I work with new writers, as I did as writer in residence, there's occasionally people are concerned about working with editors. They think they're going to somehow damage their deathless prose or something. And I explain that editors actually make things better. That seems to be your experience.
Yes, I would not work without an editor. I wouldn't do it. And when I say an editor, let me back up. In case someone is out there who doesn't know about editors, there's multiple kinds. There's a developmental editor, which is what Jessica is. And there's copy editors, and those are the people who do the timeline, nitpicky but very important stuff, like you killed this character on page 12. And they're back doing a fight scene over here, or you change this character's gender midway through the scene, or you started out in a truck and now they're in an airplane, that kind of thing. And then there's the line editors who do the even more nitpicky things, like fixing quotations and that sort of thing, and making sure there's no duplicated words. Jessica can do all of those. But her primary importance to my work is as a developmental editor. And she rips the plot to shreds, which is what I asked her to do when we first met.
Now, you've been writing a long time. Have you been surprised by how people have embraced your words over all these years? Or pleased, at least?
I don't know if happy or pleased fit exactly what I feel. I think embarrassed and humbled and sort of tongue-tied when people gush. I don't know what to say when people like what I've written. I've learned to say thank you with some sort of regularity. in the appropriate, most of the time, in the appropriate spot. But it's, I will admit, it's difficult to believe that people like my work.
They seem to. Well, we're towards the end here. So now it's time for the big philosophical questions, which is not that big. Well, maybe it's a big question. I don't know if it's particularly philosophical. But the question is, why do you do this? Why do you write? And on a bigger scope, why do any of us write? And then being more specific, why this kind of stuff, this kind of science fiction and fantasy stuff?
Well, I've written... Let me answer the last one first, the last part first. I've written science fiction fantasy because I got bored with the format required from thrillers and writers. Thrillers and mystery, excuse me. I know that sounds dreadful to all of my mystery fans, but they were always current world driven. And that put limitations on the writing methodology that I just got tired of. And I had always loved, back when I was even more strange than I am now, that strange young girl, that odd young girl who buried her nose in books, I had always liked other worlds and flying dragons and knights in shining armor and, more importantly, women who could fight their own battles. So I got tired of writing in the real world, which to me mystery is, and I wanted to write other things. And that's where I am now, and it's so much more fulfilling to me as a creator, because it takes a lot more effort. And when you're writing mystery, or even just the anything that is real world based, you are kept in you're kept in these constraints, and they're known and they're easy. When you create a new world system, you have to have the checks and balances in place before you start, and you have to know how they differ from reality and how they make your world harder to live in for your characters. And that's something that a lot of real world writers don't realize. They actually will make fun of people who write mystery and sci-fi, and you go, wait a minute, I have to do everything you're doing in a world with entirely different rules and many more pitfalls. So stop and think what you're saying. You're actually taking the easy way out, and I know that because I used to write that way. And they tend to get very quiet.
And why, in general, tell stories of any sort?
Because I'm still that strange little girl with a beast living inside me. I need to write. I write for my mental health. I write because when I wake up in the morning, I want the day to go well. And I can make sure it does in my writing. I can bring it to a point of fabulous conclusion if I choose at the end of each day, where something great happens or something horrible happens that I know is going to be solved tomorrow or the day after that. And there is a blessing in living that way that I don't have when I don't write. And I have thought many times over the years of giving up and when I would retire and if I would retire. And now I'm having so much fun writing again, now that I'm pantsing this new series, this new novella series, I don't want to quit anymore. I'm back to, ooh, this is fun. Yay. And I'm looking forward to the new projects.
This podcast is called The World Shapers, and we've talked about the world building side of that, but The other side of that is, do you hope that your fiction, I know, I don't think very many stories have actually shaped the world, a few classics maybe, but what do you hope that your readers, are they shaped in some way by your fiction? Even if it's just to be entertained.
I think what I get right now is, I'm so glad I have your books to read. I just discovered them, and I'm hiding from the world in your books. And I'm so glad you have a female character who doesn't sit on the train tracks and scream, "Help me, help me," like Dudley Doolittle's female characters always did. They're happy that my characters are take charge women and take charge fighters and go after the bad guys who are hurting the underdogs, and that makes them happy. When I was writing as Gwen, it was a different thematic thing, although my characters did take charge and kill their own snakes, as we say in the South. They lived in a world that was different, and they had more backup. They had people they could depend on most of the time to help. So it was a different world. And what people got from that was, thank you for addressing this issue in this wonderful story you told about polygamy, or about some trigger element that this person needed to see in print at the time, and it would help them through some problem that is ongoing in their past and now in their present. So it's different things for different people, and I'm just happy people are reading my books. It makes me weep with I said that word and I almost wanted to. It makes me weep with happiness. I guess I'm going to go back to your word. It doesn't feel real. But then I write fiction, so there you go.
And you have mentioned what you're working on, but maybe just reiterate what you're working on now.
I am working on novella number 2 in the Junkyard Cat series right now. It's being rewritten to go back to the editor hopefully soon. I have Spells for the Dead, which is Nell Ingram and the series of Soulwood. It is number 5 in that series. It's coming out in July.
I think I called it Souls of the Dead when I mentioned it. But
oh, it's Spells for the Dead in Soulwood. So, and I do that too. And I have to stop and think. That's why I had to go look it up when you asked me what the title was, because I couldn't remember. And then I have turned in True Dead, which is Jane Yellowrock 14, to the lovely and brutal and fabulous Jessica Wade. And so I'm waiting for that rewrite letter, and I hope that letter of devastation stays at least another couple weeks away, and I'll be all caught up. Yay!
And where can people find you online?
I am on Facebook. You can just hunt for Faith Hunter Author on Facebook. I have faithhunter.net, where I have a website. I don't do a whole lot on it. And then I have 2 fan pages, or 3, on Facebook, which you can find if you look for Faith Hunter Discussion Group and Faith Hunter Spoiler Group. You can do a search for that, and it should pull both of them up.
Okay.
Well, all of them.
That's kind of the end of our time. So thanks so much for being on. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you for letting me ramble on. It was incoherent much of the time, but you're very good at pulling me back on track. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks once again to Faith Hunter for being a guest on this episode of The World Shapers. That was a great conversation, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I hope you did too. Just a reminder that The World Shapers is also easily findable online. You can find the podcast at its website, which is theworldshapers.com. You can find it on Facebook at The World Shapers. There's also a Facebook discussion group if you look for that. You can find it on Twitter at The World Shapers. You can find me online, and I hope you will, at edwardwillett.com, two T's on Willett. You can buy autographed books and download some ebooks directly from my shop, edwardwillettshop.com. You can find my publishing company, which will be publishing the Shapers of Worlds anthology, featuring guests from the first year of this podcast, at shadowpawpress.com. I forgot to mention I'm on Instagram at edwardwillettauthor. And so those are some of the places you can find out more about the podcast, about me, and about my books. And I hope you will come back many more times in the future as I continue to have great guests. I've got Marie Brennan coming up, Helen Dale, Kate Elliott, Jeremy Zoll, and others in the works coming up in the near future. So lots of great stuff to come here on the World Shapers podcast as I continue to talk with the authors of the science fiction and fantasy stories that we've all enjoyed so much over the years. That's it for this episode. Bye for now.